That's right. Okay, thanks a lot. So this is mainly going to be a techniques-based talk about some ideas for trying to more efficiently find new physics at really truly TeV scale energies. So this is sort of the short outline of what I'm going to talk about. I'll tell you a little bit about how boosted kinematics work, and at least in sort of some qualitative details. Well, first off, what boosted kinematics are, and also why QCD is problematic and why we need to do something. Then I'll tell you about the solution, which people have now been starting to work on, especially in the past 4 years or so, which has fallen under this general umbrella term of jet substructure, although this represents a rather highly fragmented set of different techniques. I'll basically just walk you through the way that I usually approach it. And we'll talk about a few applications to some fairly straightforward new physics models, singly produced resonances, decaying into top quarks and Higgs bosons and things like that, and then give you a little peek at what experimentalists are doing with these techniques. So what do I mean by boosted? We're going to be interested in, quote unquote, boosted massive objects as signals of new physics. So by boosted, whenever I default to saying the word boosted without thinking, what I really mean is something that has a particle that has a large momentum transverse to the beamline. Remember that the LHC is a proton-proton collider. There's always some boost along the beamline. I don't necessarily care about that because there's always a large boost along the beamline. What's interesting is if there's a large boost perpendicular to the beamline. So in other words, a large PT. And large in this case means the PT is large compared to the mass. And the massive objects that we're going to be interested in are the things that we have up until the LHC turned on, considered to be the most massive objects we've ever found, namely the W boson and Z boson. Maybe this guy, still, jury's out on him, but we'll assume that he's there, and the top quark. Or perhaps even new things that we're not necessarily expected to be sitting in the data. All of these can be produced in the decays of many hypothetical TeV scale particles and genuinely multi-TeV particles. As I said, the simplest is just a heavy singly produced resonance. So I have in mind like a Z prime, W prime, gluon prime, graviton prime. Heavy top partners is another example. For example, can decay into a top quark and then some invisible light particle or something like that. If this guy has TeV scale mass, then the top quark that's coming out will have a huge amount of energy compared to its own mass. And heavy gluinos with decaying to top quarks, and you can insert whatever your favorite new physics model is here, as long as it basically fits this criterion that it's producing these guys, WZs, Higgs, and top quark, and that they are produced with a lot of energy. So these are roughly the configurations that I'm thinking about. So this is sort of what we normally think of as like associated Higgs production with a W boson. We have this sort of nice, relatively well-separated event. There's a B-jet over here, B-jet over here, lepton over here, and some missing energy. And we can draw circles around the B-jets that don't touch each other, and everything's kind of nice and far apart. That's, at least at order one level, what a lot of the signal of associated Higgs production looks like at the LHC. But if we imagine something like a W-prime boson that weighs 3 TeV or something like that, it will not decay into such a nice sort of stately, well-separated system. These Higgs bosons and W bosons will come screaming at relativistic velocity out of the decay, and consequently, all of their decay products will basically be shot forward along the original parent's direction of motion. And the Higgs, this would be a very dramatic and interesting signal if we could ever see something like this, an entire Higgs boson traveling so fast that it can be contained in one jet. Similar considerations apply for any of the other guys that I mentioned. Here's the top quark. This is a sort of a normal schematic of a top antitop pair production, semi-leptonic top antitop. We have four well-separated jets. You can kind of see the B jets, or their vertices are a little bit displaced from the main vertex. Muons, some missing energy. But at extremely, extremely high energy production, things get a little bit more crowded and nasty looking. Particularly the semi-leptonic top, its muon, in this case, is basically sitting right next to its own sister's B-jet. And it can get a little bit confusing about whether or not these are, you know, really isolated in the normal sense that experimentalists would like them to be. And then this just looks like a big mess. It's lots and lots of hadrons all moving in the same direction. And you know, I drew this very suggestively on purpose, you know, try and spot the displaced vertex here. This is kind of the situation that experimentalists are facing in real events like this, that it gets very, very difficult to tell that a B-jet is coming from a B-quark because of this vertex displacement, which is the usual tag. So you may not even be able to use B-quark tags. Just walk through the sort of grade school level math of this. So suppose that we have a massive mother particle M decaying to two massless daughters. Each one gets its sort of fair share of the mother's original energy. And we Lorentz boost this whole system sideways compared to the decay axis. What you get out, say now we're in the lab frame in this diagram, is the obvious thing that the daughters are sort of traveling along the boost direction. And you can figure out that the angles that each of the daughters is making with the boost direction is basically 1 over the mother's boost. So the total angle between these two guys in the lab frame is 2 over gamma, or basically 2 times the mother's mass divided by its energy. However, this would be kind of appropriate if we were working at an E plus E minus collider where we really knew the sort of longitudinal boost of the whole system. We're working at a hadron collider, so we'll do a slight switcheroo of variables. Change this into delta R and PT. And when I say, I'll explain what delta R is in a second, but when I say min, I mean, you can certainly see that if I took this configuration and I rotated it so that the boost was along the decay axis, these are basically light rays, so they're not actually going to change direction anymore, and they're still at 180 degrees in the lab frame. You'd have one blue shifted guy and one red shifted guy. So the kind of minimum angle that you'll get in the lab from putting this boost is from this sideways decay. However, there is actually a kind of Jacobian pileup for decays to happen in this configuration, or actually get a pileup of events near this delta R. So here's what I mean by delta R. If you take, say, a typical LHC detector and heavily schematicize it as just a cylinder surrounding the beam line, you can characterize where a particle is going in the detector based on 2 variables, the angle around the barrel, the phi direction, the azimuthal angle, and then this thing called eta, which is basically the boost of that particle along this direction away from perfectly perpendicular motion. But practically speaking, it's just, if you like, the polar angle off of coming out at 90 degrees. And the usual way of representing this, because it's kind of awkward to draw, is to unroll it and lay it down flat. And then we can define a variable delta R, which is just the distance in this plane, this eta phi plane. And delta R is, throughout the entire talk, just going to serve the analog of plain old-fashioned three-dimensional angle, because it's about the best approximation we can get to make any sense. So to put some meat on this, here are some actual numbers for the case of 120 GeV Higgs, which I think was ruled out a couple days ago technically, but turn this into a 5 if you so desire. So as we crank up the PT, let's start at 200 GeV. The delta R between the two guys is 1.2, which is sort of represented here as if they were coming out, we're like looking down the beam pipe around the barrel of the detector, like here. It's a pretty appreciable distance, angular distance, so that if we tried to separate these out using normal techniques, there's not really much problem. But we start to get into an awkward situation, say when we get up to PT of 500 GeV. This is the normal size for an LHC jet. So they would start to actually end up getting clustered together using normal LHC reconstruction methods. And you're really getting into hot water when you get up to, say, 1,000 GeV or TeV. And you know, this is basically just shrinking linearly as the PT is increasing. And here's a histogram showing a distribution from, say, we had a 2 TeV Z prime decaying into Z Higgs. Look at the delta R distribution between the 2 B quarks that come out of the Higgs decay. And they're sort of piled up near this edge, right? From a 2 TeV Z prime, the typical PT, transverse momentum of the Higgs, is about 1,000 GeV. So it's basically this case. And you get this 0.24 for the minimum delta R, which you actually kind of see represented on this plot. This is bad. I mean, from just an ordinary LHC reconstruction tactic, all of these events, say you were using a radius of 0.4 to define what you mean by a jet, all of this stuff would get grouped together and just be one jet, and then some fraction, maybe half, would still survive as two jets. But you're in this really kind of awkward transition region. Bottom line, at high energy, everything becomes, quote unquote, a jet. It's really, if you think about it, analogous to the conceptual transition that we made with basically all of the other formerly heavy particles of the standard model. You know, tau, charm, and bottom were all considered very heavy particles in the 70s. But these days, we kind of think of them as getting tossed around like ping pong balls and being produced with huge energies, and they all decay into one direction. And we think of the tagging these, literally doing like tau jet tagging, charm jet tagging, bottom jet tagging. Now we have to kind of amp things up, say, think of taking a Z as the resonance of choice and turning into a Z prime to getting into TT bar, Z Higgs, or WW, just as an example. In some ways, it's a good thing that everything's kind of moving in the same direction. I mean, the combinatorics becomes trivial. If you remember that plot that I, or that picture that I showed of a TT bar event, a top pair, there were a lot of jets. There were four jets in the event. They're kind of going every which way. And it's a little, it's not immediately obvious how you want to pair jets up with each other to reconstruct the tops. Let me just go back to that and show it to you. Like this case. So it's, you know, these guys don't really, like the B jets don't come with charge labels, and these light quark jets don't come with any labels. So it's hard to tell whether this B jet gets, you know, came as a sister to this muon or whether it was this B jet. Whereas here, it's, even though it looks kind of nasty, it's really obvious that this is the B jet associated with the muon. There's also more complete radiation containment. I mean, the LHC detectors are just filled with basically junk radiation from proton-proton collisions, from pileup from uncorrelated proton-proton collisions, as well as just from sort of the remnants of the hard interaction, or the soft remnants of, surrounding the hard interaction that, say, produced the whatever interesting particle you're trying to look for. But if everything is sort of, so this forces you to have to kind of contain your jets from the decays you might be interested in. Say, if you imagine these top quarks are peppered with lots of extra junk, you don't want to take huge jets because you're going to pick up lots of junk peppered around them. However, here you can actually get all of the top quark decay products in a fairly nice compact cone without having to worry about, say, all the stuff that might be coming out at large angles that you don't care about. Dangerous backgrounds can also become smaller. So these kinematic configurations are weird in some way, and that can be used as an advantage for killing off things that may have naively been very bad for your analysis. Also, some backgrounds will just go away due to PDFs falling off very quickly, like glue initiated backgrounds fall very quickly. So in some sense, things are becoming simpler and nicer for you. On the other hand, it's becoming bad. I keep saying these words that normal sort of jet reconstruction causes the two particles to become clustered together or merged together. I'll go into more detail on this in a second. There's also this problem that there is, if there's a huge amount of energy flow, this is just a kinematic problem. If there's a huge amount of energy flow through the core of a jet, any soft radiation, any of the sort of pepper that might be floating around inside the detector, even just noise in the detector, that sits near the periphery of the jet will significantly affect, if you try to say measure the mass of the jet, large angle soft things can have big impacts. It's a little counterintuitive. Remember, if you're adding up a bunch of four vectors together and taking their mass, say you add up two light-like four vectors, the delta m squared is basically going like the product of their energies times their separation, their angular separation squared. When you sum this up over all of the junk, so I add here, this is like basically the density of uncorrelated, uninteresting radiation in the detector. UE for underlying event and PU for pileup. the total shift in the jet mass, if you're trying to measure it and see that it's, say, the Z mass or Higgs mass, the squared shift goes like the fourth power of the jet radius that you used. As you scoop up more and more stuff, and it gets weighted more and more toward the invariant mass because it's at higher and higher angles. This is a real problem. There's also just the problem that if you're looking at things that are happening at small angles, it's a new regime for the detector to come and do annoying things. So you do have to actually pay a little bit of attention to whether or not the detector has the ability to see the features you might be interested in. And as I said, B-tagging actually degrades very quickly at high PT. Between like 100 GeV and 1,000 GeV, I think the mistag rates go up by like more than an order of magnitude. Yeah. You might be able to do something like that, but if you're just measuring the mass, you know, you need to account for the fact that.
I guess this statement has to do with a fixed cone kind of algorithm.
It would be actually any algorithm. In fact, I think KT, like the other combination algorithms, tend to be worse because they can be a little bit. They can look a little bit more like amoebas in the detector, so they can go and have these little tendrils that go out to really big angles and scoop up more junk. Fixed cone actually, I think, tends to be a little bit better than those. But yeah, I mean, there are certainly ways you can think of getting rid of this. But we know how to get rid of it at this point, basically. But if you're just starting out and just measuring what's in the jet, it's a problem. Okay, here's just a picture of some QCD jets from CMS. Maybe just to illustrate to you a little bit why you need to even talk about jet clustering. So these are kind of garden variety type events. This one's kind of fun. It's a Z, or maybe it's neutralinos, recoiling against three blobs of energy. This is actually two B quarks being produced. But you can even just see in this event, this is nominally, you would first pass think of this as a two-body production process. You make a B quark and it goes this way, and you make a B quark and it goes this way. Quantum chromodynamics will shower will cause huge amounts of excess radiation to be released as these things propagate out of the interaction. And so you actually don't get two particles. You can get, say, 20 or 50 particles or something like that. And in general, it's not possible to just take all of those individually and predict where any of them are going to go or deal with that high a multiplicity of particles. So the usual approach is to figure out some kind of inspired way to add them all up to sort of rebuild the originator B quarks that made this thing. You can see even just in this simple example, there's already some non-trivial questions you can ask, like, is this really two quote-unquote jets, or is it just one jet? There's no actual right answer, right? I mean, this is kind of like somewhere between classical physics and quantum physics. You're building up a classical radiation pattern around this detector, but discretely, just with a high multiplicity of particles. And sometimes you get sort of lobes of energy, and sometimes you know, get isolated little guys over here. Sometimes you just get soft stuff sprayed all over to the sides. It's very complicated and very messy. And the usual approach is just try to make it less messy. The problem is when you do that, for example, if you scale the energy of this up, maybe this was a Higgs jet, and maybe this was an entire B quark, and this was an entire B quark. And if you use this approach and you try to just cluster this out so you don't have to worry about the exact detailed distributions in here, you'll get yourself into trouble. You'll actually lose the information about the internal decay kinematics. So there's one kind of obvious answer. Why don't you just use smaller jets? You know, if you think that you're dealing with an event where this is really a Higgs boson is really at this size scale, then just use jets that are tuned to be at this size scale. This does present a little bit of a Goldilocks problem. You know, you have to choose a radius. Fine, maybe you have some inspired way to do that. But you have to tailor it as a function of the event energy. So you're implicitly introducing some kind of user-defined mass scale when you do this, which may or may not bias what you're doing. It might work, but it's not immediately going to be the best thing you could do. Maybe a more fundamental problem is that the mass and energy resolution start to degrade. You're making the event which nominally, say, started out, you clustered it up so that it looked like a two-particle event. If you use a smaller radius, you may get events that look like they have 10 particles or 10 jets in them. What do you do? If you only took two of those, say, to reconstruct a Higgs, then maybe you didn't catch all of the decay products. You have to make some very inspired choices for how to do this. And you end up actually with a kind of a big combinatoric problem. So it's not obvious that this is a great thing to be doing. You might also just try to go and use a huge jet. And then be great. You can just capture all the radiation. This is also bad. So you lose all of the information on the internal multi-body kinematics of what you're trying to catch in a single jet. So basically, any QCD jet will be able to fake your boosted massive object, your boosted Higgs, your top. And there's also just a more practical, another practical problem, that the mass of a jet actually scales with its size, a QCD jet. There's no sort of intrinsic mass scale built in to how QCD breaks apart partons. But you kind of implicitly introduce one by, you know, this has some energy, this has some radius that you chose by hand, that introduces a mass scale, and it's just going to get grow and grow. So that typically what happens if you use like a normal LHC size jet of like, say, 1/2 to 1 or something in radius, for like a TeV scale energy jet, the mass will just automatically come out on average to be roughly 100 GeV, which is smack dab in the middle of where we do not want it to be, because we would like to be able to actually look at a jet, for example, measure its mass and tell that it's a Z boson. That's going to be difficult if ordinary, boring, garden variety QCD jets are mimicking that mass scale, just by virtue of the fact that you almost program them to. Then there's this other thing that I mentioned, that the jets are actually just full of junk. So this is an example, let's say, where we produced a WW from a resonance decay. Here's a lepton neutrino from one of the Ws, and here's a jet from the other W. Let's say we let this W decay into a lepton and this one decay into hadrons. And if you use a big jet, you're just going to be scooping up. You get that R to the fourth behavior. You're scooping up more and more of this junk, and the mass gets messed up. So the solution, one avenue solution that people have been working on, is this idea of jet substructure, where you actually figure out the correct distance scales on the detector, the correct delta R scales adaptively, event by event, instead of using sort of a one-size-fits-all jet clustering. And it's not just event by event. It's actually like patch of the detector by patch of the detector. So I said you could try to invent some size scale that seemed appropriate, but it won't always be the best thing you could do. We switch over from this terminology of having jets. We take maybe a jet that contains all of our boosted massive object, and we try to look inside of it for variable sized objects which have been called subjets. They're kind of little subclusters of energy that don't have a well-defined preset size. It's also possible to use jet shapes, and there's a pretty big industry of doing that as well, where you can kind of come up with some, like Itai was saying, some way of doing a weighted sum over all of the different energy depositions. So the basic philosophy is to take a really big radius jet, so you get the best chance of catching all of your decay products from your W or Z or Higgs. The terminology for that is a fat jet. So now we're intentionally taking an enormous jet. And then apply this substructure type methods to tell us where the decay products are actually going inside of that giant jet. I'll also mention briefly later on about the possibility to use more flexible isolation requirements for leptons. So similar idea to try to use an adaptive delta R. So instead of using the usual way that leptons are isolated is there's some sort of pre-chosen distance scale in the detector, and the lepton had better be isolated, that is, there's no other jets or no other hadronic activity in the vicinity at that radius scale. But that's obviously not going to work as you go to higher and higher boosts, say, and leptons get very, very close to jetty activity. This is mainly an issue for semi-leptonic top decay, where you produce a lepton with a jet. It's not at all, for example, an issue, but it's maybe significantly less of an issue, say, for a boosted Z boson decay, decaying into muons or electrons. Certainly, it's a little bit more challenging to deal with when things are very close together in that case, but the particle multiplicity is extremely low, and there people know how to deal with that. Then once you have gone inside and sort of done, you made a huge jet and you go inside and do kind of surgery on it, you have the ability now, you have internal kinematic information about this jet, so you can discriminate against QCD. And QCD can create substructure by virtue of the fact that it will just, through like diagrams like this, it'll just branch and branch and branch and keep producing more and more particles. You can actually go check and sort of form quasi-particles, these subjets, and see if they look more QCD-like versus more, say, Higgs-like or something like that. There's also the potential, as long as you're going in and actually checking where everything is going, to try to access more subtle aspects of the radiation pattern. And this gets maybe more back into this jet shapes idea, but there's a huge number of possibilities for doing that. And then another basic thing we would like to do is make sure that we get rid of, we'll keep the radiation that we want that's actually coming from the heavy particle decay, but then toss all this sort of surrounding junk that's just confusing us from pileups of extra proton collisions, underlying event, initial state radiation. And this sort of generally goes under the term of jet grooming. So I'm going to describe for you a procedure, which is only one of many, many procedures that kind of tries to do all these things. I will at least mention, though, that you know I'll pay compliments to all the other people who are in this endeavor. I mean, this is actually only now a tiny subset of the total work that's been going on. But at least you can start out by noting this paper up here, which kind of got a lot of this going with a pretty big time gap of order a decade from Mike Seymour. And it was then kind of appropriated by John Butterworth and Cox and Forshaw in 2002 to try to look for W jets produced from strong WW scattering, trying to probe the origins of electroweak symmetry breaking. And it was picked up again 6 years later, again by Butterworth, but with new collaborators who tried to apply it to Hingstra lung searches at the LHC. And then this really is going to form the basis for most of what I'll talk about. It's a recursive angle-based declustering into subjets with grooming, and in their case for high PT, W, Z, and H, which sounds perfect for what I would want to do for looking for like a resonance, they were just interested in the standard model. So we'll take it and we'll apply it to resonances, and we'll also apply it to basically change the technique and apply it to top quarks, and also change it further and apply it to even more weird things. There are also some advanced methods that I'll just mention quickly. I incidentally do not expect you to read all of these things. Just to give you some impression, there is a lot of work going on. So by advanced, I mean ideas that are really trying to take the very detailed shape of the radiation around the subjects, for example, and use that, for example, to do things like discriminate the color of what's inside the jet. You can have a gluon that splits into a bunch of stuff, and in some approximate sense, the net color of that jet is a color octet. Whereas if you had like a boosted Higgs boson and you formed a big jet around it, the Higgs is a color singlet. So that actually leads to different radiation patterns. They're subtle, but there are effects there. Okay, so let me actually now, I'll try to sort of gently walk you through how this works. And the driving engine behind this approach is this Cambridge Aachen jet clustering algorithm, which is basically the simplest way that we know to make jets. There are many, essentially an infinite number of choices that one can make for how to block regions of the detector off into jet A, jet B, jet C. This one just goes into that eta-phi plane, takes four vectors as represented in that plane, sequentially adds up nearest neighbor pairs. And you can, in principle, just keep doing that forever and ever and ever until you're left with only one four vector, which represents the whole event. That wouldn't be very useful. You then have to have a criterion for when to stop. So you stop when all of the four vectors in that plane are distanced by more than a pre-specified distance parameter, which you set at the beginning called R. This is very similar to sort of KT jets, which are actually also useful for substructure, and anti-KT jets, which are actually the main sort of quote-unquote circular jet algorithm that's in use at the LHC at the moment. But this one is not very useful for substructure, and this one can confuse you in some cases, although it is actually very good. But for definiteness, I'll take Cambridge Aachen. And tools for playing with these things can be found at this website, which is a FastJet website. It's a computer program for actually doing all this stuff. So here's a cartoon of an event, like severely simplified. So this is something, say, from CDF. It's a bunch of activity. Again, we unroll the barrel of the detector into this eta phi plane. And I'll just pretend that there are five particles. So let's run the jet clustering algorithm on this event to show you what it does. So what we're instructed to do is look for the closest pair. So imagine these are supposed to be particles that are sort of pointing out of this plane. And the size of the circle is basically telling you the energy. You're supposed to look for the closest of these two four vectors, which is going to be this one, those two, and add them together, like do literal four vector addition on them. So what's going to happen is the centroid of the four vector will shift, the direction will move a little bit, and the total energy will increase, as well as the total momentum. So there, I added them together. Very easy. Now, these are the two closest. So I'll go ahead and add those two together. They have roughly equal energy, so the centroid ends up sort of in the middle, and they're now roughly doubled energy. And then now these are the two closest. And if I don't stop here, I'll just end up with one big blob. But let's suppose that the radius parameter was, I don't know, yay big or something like that. So these guys are too far away to be clustered, according to that criterion, and that's it. These are the jets, jet number one and jet number two. Now imagine doing that with 100 particles, and that's roughly speaking what the LHC is doing event by event. That by itself doesn't tell us anything. The main piece of information that we get by having combined everything together like this is that each of these jets is not just a four vector now, it has an entire history, right? It's got this branching structure. So you can actually, it has a kind of a memory of how you built it. So this one is pretty trivial. We just added together two guys. So I represent that as these two guys coming together and fusing into that line. Whereas this one had a sequence of two to one combinations. So the basic idea of jet substructure, at least the way that I use it, is to then decluster this jet. So here's a slightly more complicated example where we had a whole bunch of things, cells. So imagine these are cells in the detector, calorimeter, energy measuring cells. You can go back through this entire history and then make some inspired decisions about what were the correct groupings of the cells, rather than just adding everything together and saying, that's my jet. I can go and look for new stuff. So you need some sort of criterion for what to do. And the way that we do it is we sort of walk back as if we're doing a parton shower, basically, as if this is evolving forward in time, and then make some decision. So here's the first point where the jet branches back into two pieces. We have some criterion for each branching, which determines whether or not it is quote unquote soft or quote unquote hard. And again, this is a completely arbitrary division. The way that I usually do it is by looking at the relative momenta, PT, of the two branches, and say if this branch carries less than 10% of the total momentum, I call this soft. And when you hit a soft branch, you just walk along the harder branch, and you throw away all the stuff out here. And this is even at least approximately represented in reasonable spatial terms, right? The idea is that closer cells are merged first, and then really far away cells or really far away protojets or branches of this thing are merged last. What often happens when you do jet clustering is you choose the jet radius too big. In this case, I chose it too big on purpose. And you caught some junk off near the edge of the jet. And I'm saying this is a soft branch, and this was the lower PT section of that branch. This was, for example, a 1 GeV cell and a 2 GeV cell or something that got added together. And maybe there was like 1.5 TeV of energy on this side. So you obviously don't care what's going on over here. We just throw it away. It's very, very likely contamination. This is the jet grooming part of this thing. You keep walking back like that until you actually hit a hard splitting. So now each of these guys has somehow like a democratic energy sharing or some other kind of criterion like that. And then those two branches, if you want, again, we have to keep making decisions, but if you want, you can just stop and say that that's my subject one and that's my subject two. And that is now the intelligent way of deciding what cells should be grouped together and how to make sort of jets inside of jets. That's actually a very good thing to be doing, for example, if you're looking for a two-body decay, like for a W boson or a Higgs boson or a Z boson. If you're looking for something a little more complicated, like a top quark, you'd better keep looking. Top quark, if it decays hadronically, goes into three jets, three subjets. But you can just iterate this process over and over and over again. And for example, maybe I decide that this was a hard splitting, but this had no further hard splittings inside. So this whole thing still remains a subject, but this splits into two, sort of subject 1A and subject 1B. And then maybe I have some inspired way of how doing kinematics on these where I can decide, like, this is the B quark, and these two guys are the W boson or something like that. Here's an example of an event display where I just ran this procedure for the two-body case. So this could easily have been a WZ Higgs jet or Higgs jet. In this case, I think it's a Z jet. Just to illustrate for you what fat means, I took the jet radius to be 1.5, which is basically pi over 2. So you know, this is the phi direction, and this is the jet we got. That jet basically, along the phi direction, covers half of the detector. It doesn't cover half of the eta-phi plane, because actually the eta-phi plane goes on forever. But if you're only sort of looking in the central region of the detector, say at eta from negative 2 to 2 or something, it eats up a large fraction of order 1 of the entire event. I colored these. I mean, you can see there's this red group of cells and this blue group of cells. These are the two subjets. And if you look really closely, it might be hard to see with the contrast. There's a lot of little gray cells all over the place. Those are the ones that were thrown away. So basically, we walk back through the jet clustering, and we find the last things that are going to get clustered in this procedure are the things that are at the largest distances. And that's really the stuff at the edges. And that's the most dangerous stuff, right? So we just get rid of all that stuff, and we find our way down into the center of the jet, and we have our nice two subjects. Basic procedure was from this Butterworth paper, but then it was applied to do searches by Haxin and Spadowski, by Katz, Sun, and myself. And also, in the case of decays of new physics particles, not WZ and Higgs, but something else, by Bai and Shelton. These are, so at, if I just don't put a detector in or anything, and I just show you like literal particle level results, this is what the mass distributions would look like for boosted Ws versus QCD. So I'm taking here W bosons that came from a 3T EV Z prime decay. So they're coming out with momenta of like 1500 GeV. They're extremely, extremely relativistic and very, very tight configuration. And just measure the mass of the jet before or after applying a substructure procedure. Actually, let me be a little more careful. The black line is the procedure that I just showed, where we took an enormous jet and then decomposed it down and found the subjects inside. The purple line, we just took a sort of a normal-sized jet radius for the LHC of 0.4, picked the hardest jet in the event, and measured its mass without doing any further procedure to it. And you can see that, I mean, both of these have a nice correlation with the actual W mass of 80 GeV. There is some shift for the purple line because it's accepting more junk radiation, but it's not too big because it's a pretty small distance scale. The more dramatic thing happens when you process it through QCD jets, again, of like roughly 1500 GeV momentum. The procedure where we do substructure gives you this. This is now differential cross-section as a function of the mass. So I took some slice of invariant mass for the whole event in a W plus jets event and measured the jet mass and formed a distribution. I mean, you obviously see that this is a fairly flat distribution after you apply the substructure procedure and is fairly low compared to what you would have gotten if you had just taken the whole jet and added up everything inside the jet. And basically, what's going on is that there are sort of two things. One, if you look inside a tiny little jet like this, it often only fakes the W mass a little bit counterintuitively by virtue of the fact that there's a huge flow of energy in the center of the jet and then a little blip of energy near the side. that doesn't happen so much for a real W. It tends to be more democratic in how it shares the energy and tends to be more centralized. So you actually end up, if you go and you do the substructure procedure and you throw away the junk at the periphery of the jet, you get less rate for the background. There's also the second reason why it goes down. Because you're using an enormous jet, this actually gets a little bit of color discrimination going. Because you use a huge jet, right? So we'll go back to our W jet. This actually was from a W, or a, well, it's actually, this one was actually a Z, but it doesn't matter. There isn't a lot of radiation surrounding this. I mean, there can, you know, occasionally be an ISR jet floating around in here somewhere, but the W boson is color singlet, so it doesn't tend to emit radiation along its own path or somewhere in the vicinity of its own path. It really only just decays into the quarks, and the quarks go along the parent. If this was actually a QCD jet, say a gluon, the gluon carries color. That color is connected back to all the other particles in the event, and it will radiate everywhere. So what often happens is you take a really big jet and you apply the jet declustering procedure to it, and you actually find some hard bit of radiation out here because the QCD jet, the gluon, say, would have emitted at a larger angle. And so you're getting two effects. One, some of these guys are being thrown to low mass because you're tearing out the soft sort of stuff near the jet periphery. And some of them are actually being thrown to really high mass because you're picking up extra radiation that's emitted because it's colored. And you can form a much larger invariant mass that way.
Sorry, Rob. So I'm a little confused by the normalization here.
Yep.
Where are, presumably there's really the same number of black events as there are purple events?
There's a huge spike. At zero, that's it. Yep. And essentially, you know, QCD wants to have everything to be zero mass, but it, as soon as you pick a finite jet size, everything gets biased towards having some mass. This kind of tries to undo what you tried to do. You know, the fact that you had a jet size. In fact, this whole procedure becomes very insensitive to even the parameters of the jet. Okay. You can try and form a tag like this in sort of the most obvious way. You just sort of say, well, I will only accept jets processed through this between like 65 and 95 GeV, which, I mean, doesn't look like the optimal way to slice this up here, but if you put in actual spatial and energy resolutions of the detector, obviously these things get broader, and this actually becomes pretty reasonable. And when you do that, when you actually put in the correct, at least some attempt at having a correct smearings, the total tag rate that you get is sort of roughly 70% for the W's. With missed tag rates, this bite of the total probability for the whole thing is only about 10%, or usually less than 10%. So this is our sort of our first tag for this talk, the first complete tag. Of course, just like anything, even like a B tag, the tag and mistag rates, I mean, they're based on some choice of parameters that I made, so you might not like that. I didn't even tell you what those parameters were. You may not like those parameters. You might try and tune it to be something else, but at least this gives us something that certainly, I mean, by eye looks reasonable. And I can just show you an application for new physics. I think I completely lost my model curves because of the lines were too thin on here, but I'll trace them out for you. So this is sort of the putative mass of a Z prime, and we try to run a Z prime search into either boosted W's decaying into lepton neutrino jet or dileptron, lepton neutrino. I do not attempt jet because the backgrounds are just like astronomical, even though, as I understand it, experimentalists will try to do that. And maybe just pay attention to the solid curves. So the solid blue curve is what I would expect for a 5-sigma discovery. This vertical axis is the cross section for production of a Z prime times the branching fraction into the WW final state. And these numbers tell you in femtobarns the kinds of cross sections that I would claim that you could actually get to at 5-sigma level after a 100 inverse femtobarn run of the 14, pay attention to that, 14 TeV LHC. So that I can actually get up to this, you know, I can seriously tell you 3 TeV and not be embarrassed. So, and these are, you know, the really, really challenging cases. So you see the red line is the semi-leptonic mode where I actually do the jet substructure, and the blue line is the WW into dileptron. which is significantly cleaner, but there are two back-to-back neutrinos, so I can't really measure it very well, and it has a low rate. If you do this procedure, I mean, this is just showing you that you get lower cross-section sensitivity for the semi-leptonic with substructure. Lower is better. It means you have more access to rarer production. And if you just totally turned off jet substructure, you'd be sitting on higher background, so you'd get the dotted red curve, and you'd actually be more competitive with the lepton, the dileptone. But substructure actually gives you the ability to beat it. So it's one of the sort of clean cases where you can see that there's some meat to this. And this is supposed to be showing you what models you could actually access. Sort of the sequential standard model, some warped Kaluza-Klein model, and some ordinary things that people usually look for, E6 eta boson and the T3 Wright boson. All of these can actually decay into the WW final state, even though a lot of time these things are only searched for in like dileptone, because that's easier. You can still do searches in WW and could tell you something interesting. And the model curves are kind of falling across, you know, kind of in a band like here. And roughly speaking, what I'm trying to tell you with this, so this is as we go from 30 to 100 to 1,000 in Rusumtobarn, I'm trying to tell you that you can get up to like 3 TeV cross-section, 3 TeV masses for these guys with the 100 in Rusumtobarn LHC, and actually go even beyond 3 TeV with 1,000 in Rusumtobarn. Okay. There's also the case of Z prime can go to WW. It could also go to Z Higgs. And either the Z could decay into jets or the Higgs could decay into jets. This is just the example where the Z decays into leptons, which are easy to see, and the Higgs decays into B quarks, which is most of its branching fraction if it is where we think it is. This plot isn't quite as nice as the previous one, but the takeaway point will be here is these little red, these little arrows are indicating some specific model prediction from this warped Kaluza-Klein Z prime. And whenever these arrows are above the little dots on here, it means that I can discover it. And if it's below, it means it's too small a cross-section and I can't find it. So you can see, for example, in this case, this is pretty clean. This is supposed to be 100 in Rusumtobarn that I can see a 2 TeV guy with 100 in Rusumtobarn using this mode. But I can also try and do like a primitive form of b-tagging. I said b-tagging isn't really necessarily working that well. But you can still look for muons embedded inside of jets and use that as a primitive b-tag. And it's not so bad. It's like 35% efficient for signal and 5% for background. And it does help out a little bit, but it's maybe sort of questionable over here. You can also do the same thing for an invisible Z. And you can, you know, reconstruct the transverse mass peak, go through the same rigmarole. You get kind of similar looking results. So there are a lot of channels, actually, you can do these searches in. I'll also show you, these are top jets processed through the same kind of idea. These are in the A to Phi plane. And you can see some really very beautiful three-body substructure examples. And then some where they're not so beautiful, just because you don't always get beautiful-looking jets. In this case, this entire thing is the W boson. This is one of the quarks from the W decay, and this is the other quark. In this case, this is also the entire W boson, and the B quark is like somewhere out here and didn't actually get clustered in. It's never perfect, but it actually works pretty good. These are the efficiencies that we got from our original paper on this back in 2008. Experimentalists have since picked this up, and you know, things have changed. But the basic idea was that for sort of order 1 TeV momenta, we got tag rates at like sort of 40%. And then these are sort of quark jets and gluon jets. You can, they're multiplied by 10, so even though it looks like sort of 30 and 10% type tag rates, we're really talking more like 3% and 1% type tag rates.
Is this actually implemented in the CMS?
Yes.
Right.
Yes, I'll show it to you. With the very little time that I have, I'll give you a little peek at it. But that's what we were predicting. I do note that I say Herwig on here. This is one particular program that's used to model how gluons split apart, how quarks split apart, how they turn into hadrons. Nobody really knows how to describe that in any like really fully exclusive detail. So there's always some kind of model. This was the more pessimistic model that we used. There are also other programs that you can use that give you different results, and the sort of spread. Really, the top quark tag rate, that's pretty well known, but it's the gluons and the quarks sort of how often does a gluon or a quark look like this? Yeah. Oh, in top quark decay?
Huh?
In the top quark decay?
No,
you mean the azimuthal correlations in the gluon emissions?
That's right.
Yeah.
Does that play any role actually in any of this?
That's a good question. We should try and turn it off. I'm not sure. Yeah, there is some correlation, right, depending on the polarizations of the gluons. Yeah. Oh, to play with what in particular? The correlation? I don't think anybody's talked about it. It's particularly relevant, you would think, for tops, because that's exactly the kind of thing where an azimuthal angle is even defined. For other stuff, it doesn't matter. And in fact, for the two-body substructure, the two main programs that we use, Herwig and Pythia, give the same answer. And for top quarks, they're different. Here's an illustration of what it can actually do for you. So I'm not going to show you like a resonance search or anything. Actually, I'll show you the resonance search from the actual data. So this is the top anti-top, reconstructed top anti-top mass for 14T VLHC. This is the cross-section. The plot spans 11 orders of magnitude. Because normally if you just start off and you take anything that looks diejet-like and don't try to apply any tags to it, this black line is just straight up QCD. And this red, the dotted lines, this is top quark production. So top quark production lags behind QCD by sort of 3 to 4 orders of magnitude. It's a lot more efficient to produce other types of colored things than it is to produce top quarks, even at high invariant mass, just by essentially combinatorics and gluon color charges and things like that. But if you insist that both sides of the event carry a top tag, the background from just QCD comes down by roughly 3 orders of magnitude and is now within about an order of magnitude or so sitting on top of the top quark background. Top quark background, or top quark also takes a hit. The idea is you're going to look for a bump on this curve, on the red curve, and if you have to add it to the black curve, if you have to add it to that black curve, you are not doing good. But if you have to add it to this black curve, it maybe is not so bad. There is the semi-leptonic option. I'm running out of time, so I'll just mention that you can construct an adaptive isolation cone, even though, say, a normal isolation cone would be like this big, and it looks like this guy should be vetoed. There are a lot of tricks for finding that this is really a good lepton and not like a bad lepton. So some of these variables have been picked up by ATLAS. And you can find top resonances. I'll just point to the right-hand plot. Let's say we look at, it's the same idea. Here's the mass of the resonance, and here's the discoverable cross-section times branching fraction for the resonance. And here's some model curves. So with 100 inverse femtobar, the model curves intersect the discovery curves at like 4.5 to 5 TeV. So after 100 inverse femtobar run of the LHC, you can do pretty dang good and find really, really heavy top resonances just because top quark identification is actually really good because of the multi-body nature of the decay and the fact that they're often leptons. We've also been playing around with this idea of a Di boson jet, so like a Higgs boson decaying to a WW star, which can either give you some fun things that look like a subjet doublet from a hadronic W decay and then a muon, say, from a leptonic W decay, or just a big mess of subjets. The purple guys on here were the original partons, and these colored guys are the things we found. This is not something you should immediately discount. I mean, it's a pretty healthy branching fraction of 22%. And I'll remind you, for this Higgs mass, the branching fraction to BB bar is about 60%. So I'll just skip over the results for that. And for the just like last minute or so, tell you about the experimental results. So this is a picture, actually, from CMS. Of a top anti-top all hadronic boosted candidate. It is very likely that it's actually QCD, actually, but it does use this top tagging idea, where this jet in particular was found. It was clustered into one big fat jet and then declustered into these three pieces. This one actually does something a little bit different. this one found the B jet independently and then found the W boson as a separate jet and used the W dagger. So this is a kind of a combination, a hybridization of the different techniques. The mass scale of this is 1,350 GeV. Remember, the top quark mass is roughly like 175-ish. So two top quarks at rest have an energy of 350. So each of these top quarks has a kinetic energy in the rest frame of this event of 500 GeV. Or maybe they're just jets. Don't know. Here is the top jet mass. I think this is sort of ungroomed. I think they just took the whole jet mass, which is why you see a lot of outliers. But you certainly do see a peak, like right around where you should for the top mass. And these are the tag and the mistag rates derived. Tag rates derived from Monte Carlo and mistag rates derived from the data. And you see that the mistag rates that they're getting are maybe more like 5% or so, although they're operating at a point where the tag rate is also a little bit higher. I have suspicions that these can be improved, but you know, this is all work in progress. And I'll just direct you to the resonance search on the left, which is the all-hadronic resonance search. So you can see the scale. It's a log scale, the scale of the top quark contribution compared to the QCD contribution. So you see QCD is still dominating by a lot, but this is the largest branching fraction of any of the top pair decay modes and is being used to set some of the best limits. So this is now not a discovery, but a limit setting. So these are the limits in cross-section that they're finding. So this particular model, which is some top color Z prime, they can say that its mass has to be above 2 TeV. So they're already getting to multi-TeV mass exclusions. Yeah?
All those circles are now using neural
Yep.
Including the Atlas?
Not including the Atlas. So Atlas, right now, is not totally caught up, first of all, in this part of the game. I put on here, at least to the best of my knowledge, the most updated Atlas search of this type, which is a dileptonic, actually. So they kind of run it almost like a supersymmetry search, where they add up all the visible and invisible energy, transverse energy, and then plot that and look for a bump. It's something you can do fairly quickly and easily. CMS is also doing a semileptonic search, which is pretty simplistic. They just look for some jetty activity on one side of the event, and they look for, I think, a muon on the other side of the event, which may or may not be close to another jet. The problem with this search, similar to the problem with this search, is that the red on here is tops and the rest is W plus jet. They're a little bit too inclusive. You can do a lot to improve this, quite a lot to improve this. And I know that Atlas has actually been looking at one of the variables that we proposed to try and clean this out. I think it actually is the most powerful variable on the market for finding leptons embedded inside of jets, but I don't have time to talk about it, so I'll tell you about it later. And this is, okay, that is what it is, not a big deal. Here are W jets, they found them too. So these are mostly from top quark production. It's the most efficient way to make high momentum Ws at the LHC. So here's a nice, beautiful W peak. And here's a slightly less beautiful W peak from Atlas, but this was very preliminary. Okay, so the point is jet substructure helps us to push new physics searches really into the multi-TeV regime. This will especially come into its own when we get up to a 14 TeV or near 14 TeV collider and can, for example, look for 5 TeV top quark, anti-top quark resonances, which will be pretty awesome. Boosted hadronic tops and electroweak bosons at these energy scales can be treated as taggable objects, like B jets and charm jets and tau jets are treated now. I didn't say much about it, but non-isolated leptons can actually be sort of pulled out of a jet and seen to be a good lepton. You don't have to just always insist that every lepton is sitting off in its own little empty pocket of the detector. And it's not always, you'd usually think that if you demand a lot of the signals that I was talking about have various choices for sort of how leptonic they are. The more leptons you demand, usually the lower total branching fractions you're dealing with, and sometimes less visibility because you get neutrinos. You shouldn't just immediately jump to saying that you want to demand as many leptons as possible. You often take a hit that you don't need to, because substructure actually allows you to get something back. This is especially important where there's limits to statistics, like at the very edge of a search for something really, really heavy near the tail of the distribution of something. The basic methods are now being validated on data. They're already being used to set limits. I showed you one model has a limit now of 2 TeV. And that'll just keep getting pushed higher as the energy gets upgraded at the LHC and the luminosity gets upgraded. Many different topologies are amenable to this treatment. That includes, although I didn't talk about it, boosted new physics objects, like boosted neutralinos or something like that decaying into jets if there's R parity violation, and there are many, many, many other examples. But I'll just close with the thought that, I mean, I showed you jets that basically covered half the detector, and you could tear them down and find structure inside them reliably. It seems like rather a small step to just take the entire detector in some sense and use this kind of approach literally as a global jet algorithm for the whole event. And what it will do is pick things out more on a basis of energy splittings or mass splittings or things like that, rather than distances, which is the usual way that it's done. And there can be some benefits to this, especially, for example, for new physics with extremely highly multi-jetty decays, where different quarks or gluons that are coming from those decays accidentally get close to each other, say, in almost every event, something like that. So it's still something to think about, and I think can be useful. So there's more to do. Anyway, thank you. It depends very sensitively on the kinds of questions that you're answering. But if you're dealing with things that are, say, 10 body phase space, I think you're going to have a lot of trouble. Even that's the next step beyond order one phase, body phase space. That's hugely difficult. What some people are trying to do, though, I think it'll be very. Some aspects of this might be very rigorously predictive, although I think people haven't established exactly what those might be. But there are attempts, which I glossed over. These are the sort of advanced methods, which sort of they try to pretend we actually know what we're doing. And they take Monte Carlos, which are built upon some types of assumptions, and really try to use all of the information from the Monte Carlo. You train these in the Monte Carlo, and then you port them over to data. And the idea is, if you can get control samples in your data, you can actually test these procedures. So I mean, just from a practical perspective, even if you don't know why it works, if it works, you can just use it. So there is that approach, which kind of bypasses this question of, like, can you really predict where how many things are going in what directions in the detector?